Welcome to the 12th installment of the McGill Scrivener Reading Series, as recorded live as part of the Scrivener Magazine's public performances. Today, Montreal poet Carol Davison reads from new and published works. Davison, a native of Scotland, has been writing for 10 years and teaches at Concordia University while working on her PhD at McGill. Her poems are feminist reworkings of myths. She's been published in a commemorative volume entitled We Shall Not Be Silenced, as well as the Pillar and Scrivener magazines. Today's recording was recorded at the Thompson House on January 28, 1992.
I just finished in the fall, entitled Pyroglyphics. It's a poem for Salman Rushdie. I had done my master's thesis on his work at York University. And I had a chance to meet him prior to the Ayatollah Khomeini's a critique of his work and his condemnation to die. He's to be executed whenever he's found. And I noted last fall in November, early November, journalists had said that Rushdie had been in hiding for some thousand days and nights, and I thought should they have waited another day, because the Tales of a Thousand and One Arabian Nights is very important to Rushdie's work. And so what I try and do here is weave in some of those important allusions and metaphors. Okay, it's entitled Pyroglyphics, and I have two citations. This is not something I normally do, but I do have two citations preceding the poem. One is from the first book of Corinthians, chapter 3, verses 13 to 15. It reads as follows. Each man's work shall be made manifest, for the day shall declare it, because it is revealed in fire, and the fire itself shall prove each man's work of what sort it is. If any man's work shall abide, which he built thereon, he shall receive a reward. If any man's work shall be burned, he shall suffer loss, but he himself shall be saved, yet so as through fire. And the second citation comes from Rushdie's own essay entitled Is Nothing Sacred, which was published last year in a volume of his collected essays entitled Imaginary Homelands. He says, now I find my entire world picture under fire. So pyroglyphics for Salman Rushdie. Through these thousand and one nights, this vigil against vigilantes, somewhere solitary, Salman has shared with Scheherazade a dread of the Sultan's sword, a dream of the scorching word, wise in its wizardry, that will set fire to story's soul, consume commandments set in stone. But Arabian nightmares rear up, neighing frantically, naysaying fervently, and the wound-up world turns as a legion of unlearners book burn in Brixton. Fighting the fiery word with fire seems a strange desire, an unheard-of occupation, and twisted testament to truth in this 20th century. A type of knight in shining armor charade, a benighted crusade against creative crucible heart. Yet satanic versus angelic struggle rages, missile combats missive in the form of pyroglyphic pages. Is the pen mightier than the butane lighter, the bomb, the warhead? Is the spirit stronger than the spear? Sometimes he fears not. So from shelled sanctuary, his imaginary homelands hounded, he must write for Harun and the imperiled sea of stories, imagining him mesmerized by the midnight magic, standing tiptoe on peacock chair, peering out at the mistral moon, palm placed against peaceful palm in wishful wonderment, rejoicing in the revoicing of Namaste. We are separate, but we too are one. For those of you who aren't aware, the word namaste in Hindi does exactly mean that. We are separate, but we too are one. And it is a gesture of respect to an elder when you meet them on the street. And it is the palm placed against palm when the hands of midnight come together. And the next one's entitled Glaciers, again about someone who did live in the 19th century, an American explorer. And I've sort of revised what I believe to have been this gentleman's occupation while he was exploring the Antarctic. Glaciers. Consider Charles Wilkes, 19th century American, wooed by wanderlust, an enchanted explorer of Antarctic elusiveness, a craving visionary, staving off collisions with the vacuous void in cosmos of timeless ice, imposing in its stature, brilliant in its beauty, precise. Consider the pricelessness, the glory of the glacier, the as yet untouched terrain. Consider the Charles who proved human, court-martialed for illegally charting territory that simply was not there. Superior Mirage, they called it, mocking like the gin genies that plagued his last liquid days. Reconsider Charles Wilkes, joyous voyager, mystic map maker of the solemn frozen vastnesses at the soul's quartz-like core. Reconsider this criminal conjurer, he who sought to chronicle, yet was crucified by fiction. Was he not, like us all, engaged in the god hunt? His heart, a poet's touchstone, his straying soul, a moonstone, his yearning, a Eucharist. Oh, wow, thank you. That was just finished in the fall as well. I guess I had a good fall. I was unaware that the fall was so good. This next poem is entitled Carrying. It's a poem about incest survival. She carried her love around like precious packages. Thrilled, they'd been bestowed on her. Terrified, they'd unwrap. Tears and transit transformed, enticed her earnest eyes, and she was peekaboo five again, alive to the presence of Mr. Claus, barely thriving. I spy with my little eye, remembered, repeated, like an innocuous incantation with rare revelation. Pregnant pause. Burden bigger now, with bosom triggered, her ecstatic explosion is consolation confused. She stumbles bemused, besotted, whiskey drunk with wonder, gift-wrapped heart torn asunder, but parcels intact. This is just a short piece, my version of an East meets West love affair, two very short verses. You are the Taj and Calcutta caravans and Punjabi prayer books, cardamom and saffron all rolled into one. I taste you on my tongue. I am all tartan and bagpipe, heather and thistle and holy glenfiddich. Imbibe me. This next one is entitled Sandman. I wrote this when I was 17. My grandfather had died in Scotland. That's where I'm from, if you didn't figure out it from the last poem. I was born in Scotland. And I had to tell my father that his own father had died then, and you can imagine what what that would have been like. And so I shunned the responsibility and told my mother when she came in the door. But years later, I had to sort of exercise this from myself. Sandman. Between you and awakening, myopic me sat crouched over dizzy long distance and the static morning message of your death. Masked for my father's reaction, I faltered fearfully among the waves of heaving sobs, painting as if I'd seen all the movies. An actress at 14, caught in the sharp undertow of memory when vanilla-licked corridors years earlier played the backdrop to your paralyzed smile in metal chair, exhaling sweet pipe tobacco. Recalling that in time I'd have played the soft piano like they wanted, those proud parents, equipped with the prospects of winning love and pride, with a music penniless when opposed to our silver-lined smiles and diamond silences, which frowned upon acquired talents. My simple genesis held the glory for you, Grandpa, yet withheld its cyclical catastrophe until that 14th year of my awakening. Until now, with gazing eyes glazed by birthmarked moon, I fall soul first into the phantom backdrop of gray and black, drop my lids to the curtain darkness, whisper with the sandman, and stage your resurrection.
Thank you. the towers or the city, on the echoes or the concrete and the steel. No, you think you're homeward bounce, or you're following the sound, and you're walking to the rhythm or the reel. You'll listen to the voices as you watch him. He's a thief, he's a beggar, he's a lie. But he's playing to the spin, oh, the cellar linking in, and he never hears the voices passing by. He's a half-finished heart, he's beaten down to time. He's a loser with nothing left to lose. Will he find a way back home, or will he take the road again? Will the devil's only daughter ever let the busker choose? First you try to buy him with your pity. Here's a shilling man to buy yourself a dram. But when he looks you in the eye, you know your charity is a lie. For your pity, sir, he does not give a damn. But it's the fiddle, no, the man who drives the bargain. It's the bummy wooden witch who calls the tune. And if you fall beneath the spell, sir, you've spent your shilling well. But you can listen till the rise and know the moon. He's a half-finished hero who's frightened of love. He's a fighter who never wants to fight. He's the blindest of the blind, but if he ever finds his eyes, will the devil's only daughter let the busker see the light?
This next poem is entitled Widow's Weeds. I wrote it after a drastic, devastating love affair. Most of these poems have been written after a drastic, devastating love. But this one in particular holds an important place in my heart. And on a larger level, this is the literary critic in me coming to the fore now. On the larger level, this poem is also about women's silencing throughout history and what has not been put down on paper and expressed. Widow's Weeds. Yes, it's about Hecabe, who howled in the distance at the opal moon, oddly recalling an earlier sanctuary. From damsel to mongrel, without mental metamorphosis, hers was an anguish unheeded by Homer. And it's about those widows of wailing era, from whose fragile platforms hearts were skimmed like stones over the sea's scaly swill and swell. From dreaming to drowning, without word or warning, theirs was the unsung sorrow of last century. And stinging now with the singing of it, it's about me too, a tired and tormented minstrel, possessed of dog heart and moon soul, as I peer out from this higher window onto the battered breast of cape below. From mood chord to chorus, without rest or reprieve, mine is an echo of long-buried dirges. And disbelieving then that sea-green eyes conjure tempests from out of placid depths, it's also about you, my once-upon-a-lovesick sailor, whose forget-me-not glances spoiled my chances of surviving that springtime sinking. Yet thinking now as I pace in pained and contained pattern along this stormy stretch of Widow's Walk, placed high above the strand, I perceive you at a parallel pinnacle and grieve over the plague of plunging under. Like your love-yoked brothers of yesterday, mocked by a fickle mistress, I picture you perched in crow's nest, a fear-ridden fledgling, unable to wing away from foundering watercraft. And in the wake of the wailing, like that sorority of seaweed widows, scanning the open surface for any sign of a survivor, I find myself transformed. My till death do us part heart becomes an anchor, and my soul driftwood. A couple of short ones, facades. She makes papier-mâché masks in the salon at the back of the house, catering only to Bloomingdale charade women with plenty of little plastic cards. And at 7 o'clock every evening, all across New York, in the pick-and-choose selections of their emotional face collections, they don the soiree's guise, then leave, never forgetting to close the door behind them and turn out the lights. parachutist. While you prayed for a safe landing, they sat in the back row, the ripcord of laughter taut and ready to pull and loose at that certain moment. Ignored and alone, I'm your only front row spectator who curses your performance and its elastic snap and rebound, the sting of knowing you so well. This poem comes out of my experience when I was working, God forbid, at the Toronto General Hospital in cardiovascular surgery research as an administrative assistant. And I had a very obnoxious woman come in one day and demand that I help to photocopy her son's master's thesis now. And so I, you know, thought I would immortalize this with this woman in a poem the next year. So here it is, collating for Mrs. Birnbaum. We are human resources, mined like coal from within the home secure core, reluctantly brought to offices for the great conflagration. Occupation, like Satan, comes in various forms. Yesterday, a new file cabinet. Today, Mrs. Birnbaum. Tomorrow, who knows? Welcome, reader, listener, to my own private hell. Welcome to the pink ghetto of secretarial serfdom. From coffee to copulation, as the image goes. But today, it's Mrs. B, alias Beelzebub, in full commanding splendor, armed with photocopying nightmare, prepared to set fire to my soul. Pages unnumbered, copies unparalleled, sanity undone, burning unavoidable, firing vacation, writing haven, poetry heaven, story told. This next one's entitled B&E, and for those of you who don't know street lingo, it means break and entry. And I thought that it's a very fitting metaphor for certain relationships that I've had. B&E. I have been marked by you, criminal. Every square inch of me fingerprinted by your skillful hands, carefully caressed and committed to memory for a future crime. And when the time comes, I am mindful of your mystery, body full of your beauty, blind to your break-in. When the police arrive, I present myself as evidence, but am arrested for indecent exposure. Stolen hearts aren't on the books anymore. And this one was published in Scrivener, so it's redundant perhaps, but I'm going to read it anyway. It's entitled Bedlam, and I was working here with the notion of development in a relationship. Sometimes does happen like that. I was applying seasons of growth and to this poem. Unfortunately, it sort of becomes regressive, and you'll see why. Bedlam, spring. They, being young and foreseeing no wounds, neglected to bring the necessary bandages. Summer, here, on the black and blue horizon of breast and belly and buttock and all of their brokenness, comes the chorus. The rhythm of limbs as love in limbo dips and sighs, heavy tongue between bent knees, the isosceles of thighs. Fall. Here, locked in head-to-heart combat in this bedroom battlefield, ribs become cages, struggling for elbow room amid shoulder blades. When musky wedlock wanes into dusk-bound deadlock, may one burst out of bedlam? Winter. They being bruised and constantly cut by the corners of each other, defied healing. They being old and constantly caught in the corners of each other, embraced madness. Excuses. I thought you only held a tiny piece of me, conscious and contained. Yet you breathe with me at night and tear me from sleep with restless visions. I roll over to lose myself again in the paradox of dreams, the zippered bag of delusion and fear, where there is no escape from reality and no rationality in illusion, where proportion becomes a balloon for problems only, and conceals nothing but the sharp prick of freedom. But it seems that I am not meant to sleep tonight. So I sit by the window and watch the dim filter of headlights lick along the walls in a frenzied dance with the shadows. But the darkness resumes. I remember when we lay awake inventing the cause of this event, playing games around its effect. Strange that you aren't here to watch this with me anymore and whisper against our silhouettes. Yet maybe it's a blessing, for although you delude me in dreams, your somber smile lies exposed as a lip service lullaby of yesterday, adorned with the fragments of unfulfilled promises and the oozing jelly of regret. Excuses, framed in gaping open mouth and bloated lips, now useless to the deaf who neither want nor care to listen. This next one's entitled Catherine Wheel. And Catherine Wheel was it's a paradoxical term. Catherine Wheel was, it meant cartwheels. It was those little turns children did in the parks. But it also referred to a torture wheel upon which certain Saint Catherine, I believe, was killed. And I apply this metaphor, this term, this object, and its associations to being distanced from someone, the sort of torture in being away from them, but also the joy in sort of reliving your own memories with them. And it's both good and bad, very paradoxical. Catherine Wheel. In the abyss of your absence, I fall, recalling the clutch and clasp, that precious gasp, an aftermath grasp of fingers. I figure that believing in the cleaving cleanses, that passion has a grace that heals. This space reveals this conception while concealing self-deception. Such ordeals involve you leaving a million times. I see barbed wire, hear chimes, and I die with it, in my Catherine wheel waiting, while coming to terms with the distance of this instance. This next one's entitled Last Remain. It was a sort of philosophical piece when I was sitting drinking one evening at the dining table in the midst of a terrible breakup, of a terrible relationship that I knew I had to end. You're my therapy, you see. Right? This is my therapy. So I decided I would write this, and perhaps it will mean something to those of you who've been in throes of that, the ending of some awful thing. Last Remains. This is a small room, and my life is short, a blink in the eye of time. Honey, can you spare a dime so that I may impart this to the operator? Our creator, who arted this switchboard of fancy, will probably laugh. My gaffe may go down in the poetry books, wherein unknowing reigns supreme. For now, I will dream of timeless, mirthful plains, where I will leave my last remains. And because it's the end of January and very gray outside, I thought I would end on a more upbeat note. You know, I'm in the mood for some sun, and this is my attempt at comedy. This is my Fat is a Feminist issue poem. I came home after drinking when I was, I don't know, 21 or 22, convinced that I was becoming the big blimp of the century, and decided, well, at least I'm going to go out in style, so I'll just keep drinking. Had another drink, and within half an hour came up with this poem. So... laugh, why don't you? Just desserts, before and after. Somebody always plays tricks. It grows during snow, rain, hail, or heat. As fastidious as your mailman and the bills that get there, even during a postal crisis. There is always some body growing. Take my body, please. Please is rarely, or either the mirror is faulty, or my eyes, although they grow too when desserts are mentioned. Abstain from desserts, deserts, and the lack of food, just water. Yet it grows on water, in crackers, and sherbet, and dumplings, and especially lemon meringue pie. Take my motto, please. It's always profane to abstain, and life, well, it just isn't right without a fork and a knife and apple pie and the boy next door who won't come near because closes out due to jelly belly. Take my magazines, please. They eat me, full of befores and afters, the cost of which never ensures calories lost, of which I'm in definite need. I eat before and I eat after. I love to feed. Perhaps it's greed, but nevertheless, it's my guess that they strap those women in with girdles and pins. Mercy, it's a sin. I don't even fit a seatbelt anymore. Take my ideas, please, for it may be suicidal, but at least it's by my own hand and spoon and pizza cutter and spatula and fondue fork. Well, maybe I'm obsessed. At least I'm not depressed by all these images. At least I'm not strapped in. They can bury me in a piano case for all I care. That is, if they have my size. Take my fantasy, please. I'm in heaven, where I get 7 servings of everything I love. Up here in paradise, I'm somebody. And Christ, do I eat my meat, as if it's the last available. I didn't die early. God, no, I lived to be 330 pounds, that is. And when I deal with my meals and my female friends at our Last Supper, we realize the lies and despise the images that strapped us in. At least here, we get our just desserts, both before and after that special grace addressed to our once misplaced mother, who art comfortably in heaven kitchen. Thank you very much.
Been listening to poet Carol Davison, and the music for today's show was by Brian McNeil from a CD entitled The Busker and the Devil's Only Daughter on Temple Records. Next week, dub poet Michael Pintard will be featured. The next live performance will be an open mic night on Tuesday, February 11th at 8 p.m. at Thompson House, 3650 McTavish Street, where the audience is invited to read their prose and poetry. Until next week, I'm Mark Sloan for the McGill Scrivener Reading Series on CKUT FM.
What's up? This is Kid Koala. You're listening to CKUT in Montreal, 90.3 FM.
Good day and welcome to the Scrivener Reading Series program on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm Jason, and today we're taking a break from our usual format with the Panoima series to feature the poetry of Todd Swift. Thank you. Okay, I'd like to welcome Todd Swift, representative of the Quebec branch of the League of Canadian Poets, and welcome to our studio.
Thank you, Jason. I think I'll just start right away.
Okay.
Bring some poetry. Satire and flattery for the rich and famous. Hard to decide whether to poke fun or leap with one stroke onto the bandwagon of the filthy few in power who harness each dog pulling for its hour and, too busy holding up the world, are unable to retire. Let it roll like a head taken off then, and I will join the diminished line of honest, even righteous bards who pretend to manna and are meantime starved. No need for Kate Hensby. What I know is of no good use to you. I would like to hesitate at your door. I will not tenderly embrace these children you bring me, refuse the straw on the floor. I am, of all poets, least blessed. The wren or the eagle are not mine, nor the swan. I love the slim, starved word, live ink poor. There are very few things you need to hear. Concern is better than to ignore. The wind is colder alone. The water is no darker, though you be married or without line. We die, oh, we so often do, perhaps carefully and beckoned backward. We may perish kissing a single hair, perfect strand, or blind to the blonde stream. I can gather you wisdom in a thimble of cream. Pour it into your blackest cup, alleviate the tea of your fears. Certain poets crave that you listen, bent at their highest wall, pleading an aperture. My failed shelter leans in the air, rain glistens and wants abandonment. Go far, farther then from me, dear. Hold only that I worked here in signs well that said precious little. We should wear what we love and go out to the elements rarely, to see the curved stones of our families where they are. It is too simple to write what is yours is mine, but some events like clothes are shared, lives broken steam like sweet just leavened bread fine to eat now if both hands are gentle to bite, mouths eager to speak. I become this year's wan prophet of quiet poems, beg a light weakness for us in the new-made bed. In Memoriam, Whiskey. Dr. Ballard will not hear of this, nor Morris, or the one in the hat. Elegies for those pets who have fallen are small, embarrassing, traditional, like sonnets written in the 20s by women. No one cares to publish them in back pages of the Gazette, though there are fanatics who think Egypt dies with their cat. I loved you in my cradle, and then forgot how you were the only one to curl there late, or how you coughed up your daily source of fur. In later years, I discovered the paperweight nature of a thin, diseased animal, thought of merely as something to get in the way, scuttling underfoot, spayed senseless, madly purring, mewing for more chow. It was possible to hate. Still, the chaplain mustache, the patched gray coat, the wobbling demeanor of a drunk set you differently apart in the alleys where death finally has strayed. Neutered, yet fierce for one-fifth of this flea-bitten century. Letter from Duino. I compose out of anything you send me, enveloped by the unrelenting prowess of the angelic I have summoned to address your elegies. Charming as the climate is, castles unnerve my childlike bearing. I hear voices out of order, uncommon ones that clamor for otherworldly outlet. When I have no provisions for their desire, except when setting pen to paper, as I do now in an exceptional frenzy of mixed purpose, to plunge further past them or to entertain such visitors. Nowhere is the answer except in furor. I stay all hours by the light, praying for an end to this holiness, the insistence of delight. Would it were possible to praise by day, but then is the one chance I have for rest. Eternity must lie in wait of this work's finishing, when I am done cherishing its outer references. Already I am bent on dream proportions. Thought of our conversations sends a heat upon my forehead that hands cannot minister away. Love is this ready to enter and employ. Wings have grown on what was destroyed. Fancy my state, embarrassingly exalted, without visible reason, servant to a muse I cause, in addition to your soul, driven by an admixture of earthly abandon and infinite control. A sip of coffee there for a moment. When it is over. Soldiers who have lost their wars and sit smoking, their shirts loose because they will not eat. People who are dying in beds that can be moved mechanically, that lift and descend like swings. Lovers who stand in kitchens after they are no more, the tea steeping into a cold oil for the night. This next poem is called Hymn, and I spelled it H-Y-M-N, as in the religious thing. Hymn. There, in your face, is the face I would touch, though the hands I carry are too long. They would starve you, my hands, like long iron poles set in the ground for a prison, and all the birds strutting beyond, for the guards lay the bread there, taunting. No one has thought to print the reasons for the length of the term, the crime done. My hands would make a church of a rain barrel. How the water is scooped slick off the portion uppermost to the sky, reflections of a fluid altar, black with autumn's wafers I call leaves fallen. There is, upon your face, the idea of a church built on water, a less modern notion, the effects of motion I strike with my hand upon the flat of the rain, water in the barrel move the light there, forcing a second face, a persistent change of emotions on it, a looking away glass. Alas, I have forbidden food to enter my church. It stands empty of nutrition, my very tall cathedral of poured rain curved in the wooden barrel, left out to contain the elements that tremble persistently from out of the sky, fallen. Your face needs light as it does bread, but in this climate skin grows sick on the sun, so gather a white mask of protection and spread your tanned fingers across your face, obscuring your red mouth. Spread the white solution of protectant oil upon your lips like semen smearing a rose. I will not resolve to stop at kissing your red mouth only. I will spend the better part of Easter, all Lent, taking your clitoris upon my tongue. I am that young. I love the positions of the light in the church made of stone water, boiled to the columns of the reflected cloud shadows as my brother takes another shot in the panic club. Nine ball is the game he has chosen to impress the lean women with there, and his water church is made of beer. It would appear he will leave never alone from his place in the church. Your face is a gradual tenderness of failing. I touch your hair, and it is made of rain, marble rain. This is desire turning to beauty. This is the gesture of the proverbial madman ruining his clothes in the open square, moaning far past the clock towers, wailing higher than the pitched moon, its pew of stone pale and empty now that the prayers in the sky are over, children gone that bent forward with tiny hands and signaled to their parents and the churchgoers that they held a small belief enough to grow it, up through the palms they leaned together and out over the bone roof of the moon night, as the rain makes pillars out of air. The air children, who I have watched to learn the sullen fact of their goodness never good enough to pierce the cancers, aligned against your face is the crescent of a tear, mine I have delivered to you from my left eye. I wish to visit your mouth with sorrow in the shape of tears. I think a church should be a surreal poem. Never is there enough skin to stretch over the both of us. We remain somehow absolute, absolutely identical to our own place. If we were removed from our pockets of space, we would not become the other. I cannot lean far enough into you with my hands to believe the prayer. There is a religion between us which is an absent region of despair. I provide for every moment of this day by weeping unreal poems. There is a gesture of power in a fiction that we can adore. Be strong and break the water. The church will hold. It is in the ones who have run out the far door, who are terrified of the lions roaring in through the main gates. Your beauty is a transformation of desire. I have printed out the Bibles myself. Each is bound in black marble and ripples with the undue presence of light reflected through water, which is, of course, produced from an eye. The eye is a tiny ocean stirred through a lens uncorrected by the Lord. And on the first days of my eyes, I opened upon angels shaped like lions who roared the air like meat was soon to be unrolled from the beasts like bark from a medicinal tree. My brother, Jordan, has sunk the blackest ball and won the game on the green table where he shall not sleep with the tawny women who are not his cup of wine. Remember that each person who has lived or is living is more full of things that have happened or that are due to occur than any book that is ever to be written. The Book of Plagues is a system of paradigms balanced on each other's analogous shoulders. Yes, but we will die ourselves sufficiently to never require opening past the earliest chapters until resurrection shall close the tome, and we no longer see mere words. The body risen twice is what language should aspire to fear. The language of bread and water is the voice of the open-air prison released from you, and come to me. Turn your face to my face and join hands.
Tell me a few things about the League of Canadian Poets.
Well, Jason, first of all, I should mention that I'm the Quebec representative for the League of Canadian Poets, which is a mighty-sounding title, but in fact what it really means is that I'm the representative for the Quebec region, and every province has a representative. The League itself is made up of more than 200 professional poets, people who have really literally from all walks of life who have published more than one book of poetry. But recently what they've done is the League has opened up their membership to a wide variety of very interesting, as it were, subgenres of poets. Now, dub poets, people that have made cassettes of their work, people that have only published chapbooks. And what they're doing is they're, as it were, empowering a whole new group of poets and redefining the idea of what it means to be a real poet or a professional poet in the country. So the League is quite exciting. It's it celebrated its 25th anniversary last year, and every year there's an annual general meeting, and poets from across the country get together, and they talk about their work and political issues. The League is quite political. Perhaps it could be more so, some would argue, but it has a very strong feminist caucus, which was formed approximately 10 years ago, and it's open to men and women, but it's mostly concerned with sexual politics and social issues in this country and abroad. And anyway, so every year the League gets together, and there's a grand gathering. There are awards given out to the best book of poetry by a woman writer and the best new book of poetry by a Canadian author, and it goes fairly smoothly, especially considering that, as one person recently mentioned at the League this year, that trying to get a gathering of poets together is like herding cats. I mean, in a sense, they're very, you know, it's a nihilistic bunch of people. They're fairly individualistic, and the fact that we all sit together and eat our meals in the same room and get together and discuss issues rather calmly is remarkable. And the rest of the year, the League facilitates readings in schools across the country and helps to really, as it were, negotiate between the government and the Canada Council and defend the rights of writers and, in general, promote the idea of support for the arts from the government. So it's a very worthwhile organization.
Okay, well, now back to some poetry.
13 reasons for not looking at a blackbird. 1. The dead are not impressed with us. 2. Money ran out. 3. I would prefer to be alone right now. 4. Who dares speak the language of the birds? 5. There's a war on. 6. We ought to be fighting a war instead. 7. Time is wasting. 8. No more film in the camera. 9. She blinded me. 10. Nature is dead. 11. Consequently, it is not impressed with us. 12. There are no poems worth writing. 13. Beauty has flown from our land, a black bird. Reina. I have been careful with the axe. I have put everything away. I have been for several years everything promised you. Seldom has it seen so much darkness this night, gathering itself as if for an announcement of greater weather. The snow in the yard is heavy. It is capable of covering the ground. I have left nothing out that could be stolen. I ran into the snowstorm with both arms lifting what you wanted brought in. I am tired now, and would that you touched me. I lied for several years to you, Reina. I did this out of love, with conviction softly on my brow. What has it profited me, this profession? Oh, the reticence, the silences are glorious. Very little has it paid. The compliment is later, I am certain. What have I done with the gloves? Reina, darling, I told you that on purpose they have been left to gather for an entire winter the waste of frost to crack. Compensation is impossible. Often I lie awake torturing myself with all those poems I decided not to write. They will not forgive me. I am bursting outwards like a bucket of water that is frozen, relentless the amounts possible that gather. 4 poems I refused you, my love, 4 never given. The 5th lies at the foot of the garden and is waiting with eyes closed, without speculation. I was once a child, yes, why do you ask? Reina, you were also, do you not understand how terrible it is to find distance at the heart of coming closer? I have put everything where it belongs. The pages are put away. The desk is neat as if the work had never been committed here. The house will be closed for summer. All here will be closed. The proper state of fiction is similar. There is no Reina. I carry the axe backwards to its handle and retire to the cellar, where dark, swollen vegetables keep quiet, always. Enclosure is endless. This morning you awoke earlier than I and stole to the attic where I am preparing the anthology and tore out that poet you tell me is awful. I know he is. I am not ready to ask you to give his poems back. Keep them. Reina is 5'7". I have no photographs of either of us separate or together. I remember through the sensation of touching cold glass, windows, and recalling that each event is itself preparing no other. Each event recalls its own coming. I have left nothing out for the night, Reina. Sonnet after Fireflies. You said it was like summer, I have never liked the summer. It takes our clothes off. We become our bodies, whether we want to or not. But the candles looked like light, having difficulty getting through the trees in the way they do in summer, the trouble on the ceiling. We lay in winter, bed, nicely displaced, willing to be convinced out of January, for the safe heat love could come to accept night as May, remove bright shorts and sleep as if never. I agree to this room of widened weather, Kate. Epic stanzas. And I should mention that this is an anti-war poem, although I think it's fairly obvious. It's written in response to events which are recently occurring in August 1992, for those that may come upon this in later years. Epic stanzas. Now are the gods of war come into their own. Men in armor, men without clothing, women who are to be raped, women who will take a knife to the sleeping boy in the tent, men and women with iron wings and strong swords, and the lightness of air to bring them to us, walking like spiders on the current, across the field, set on fire by the archer, his sinews revealed, his tan painted upon him, the horses screaming in the night, the raid under darkness, the women to be raped, the animals put to the sword, the home set on fire, the men and boys drinking water from the leather pouches made by their women that they proudly wear. Now the gods of love are sleeping in their soft beds, wrapped together, not one of them leaning down to put a stop to this. There is gold enough in heaven for their dreams, and peace has promised it will come after the endless storm. The men and women listen and hear horses, horns, and run to their homes, through fields, past the beasts feeding there, and come out into the sun with their own weapons made after the image of their gods. They are well worn with use. They will withstand much battle. They look clean in the brightness of the day. This is a religion to be engaged in forever. It has much to offer. It is secure. It has an above and a below. Each of the warriors is named after a planet or thing from nature, and has a shape for love and a shape for war. And never do they meet. They wear separate helmets. Gods are neither earth nor air. Men and women are what death is for. Albanese. I enjoy the part where the barber lathers the nape of your neck, and it is warm like entering a woman, but on the outside here, and soap is sliced from its slide down your throat to the collar, the blade loose in his expert fingers quickly by the ears, tracing exactly the firm outline of distinguished blood he does not let flow. I love the answer the barber has for long hair, which is to end it, keep lines short. He cuts a fine poem in his shop littered with ears they brush from the floor. I figure he could kill me for my money if he did not love my business so. The Landlord Hate. I would rezone the lines and turn your house out of doors, and without land would let you in to my room, where I set a fire like a well-laid table, all the bone and silver of it clean for the meat, the wine, and sit you down and bid you eat the hearth, the cinders, the flame, the heat, the wood, until your stomach sweltered and you died. But before you did, I would call a doctor who would put out your food, and you would rest, and burnt be returned to your senses, and love me like we had never met. This is the dream of the absentee lover, the landlord hate. Poem circa 1940. Sleep curled in whatever shield will keep you. Sleep even by yourself, far away from me, so long as you can survive and live sanely. Sleep like love's enemy, deny your lover. Give your full feeling treason, go against devotion. If it will make you last, annihilate for caution. Lie in any arms, hold on with any reason. Do not be afraid to swallow poison inside. Inside will take it. The heart is made to be nullified. Never hesitate to walk into darkness like it were glass. Doubt not your mouth can rend the deepest flower. Possess no belief you fear will falter. Relax to cower. I can love you, no matter the isolation. Love is common with pain. Love is a national distress. It is pain-sharing, resolved by our heartless armistice. And I'll read just one more poem, a short poem. the pattern for Kate. Distance is a lie we must believe. My love, it is light for us to carry. Never grieve. You are in me, as if one image over another lay superimposed. Bodies are unnecessary when the mind's tracery outlines a flowering plate. Burnt off in heat, what stays is still bright. It is right to eat from this night garden. Hands cover the eyes. That is all to happen when you seem to leave and I appear to die.
I'd like to thank you, Todd, for coming in.
Thanks very much, Jason, for giving me this opportunity to read.
No problem. You've been listening to the poetry of Todd Swift, the Quebec representative for the League of Canadian Poets. He has been published in a wide variety of magazines and journals, including Matrix, Quarry, Pun to Infinity, and as well in an anthology called A Discord of Flags, Canadian Poets Write About the Gulf War. He was an editor, along with Martin Mooney, of an anthology of Northern Irish poetry called Map Maker's Colors. He has also published two chapbooks, one called The End of the Century and another called The Cone of Silence. He is currently at work on an anthology of contemporary Anglo-Quebec poetry while completing a BA in creative writing at Concordia University. He lives and writes in Verdun. For more info about the League of Canadian Poets and the work that they do, you can call 766-5589. You've been listening to the Scrivener Reading Series program. We can be heard weekly on Tuesday afternoons at 2 on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm Jason. My thanks to Martin Grises. Please join me next week.
La pensée pousse dans vos oreilles, vous écoutez CKUT Radio FM 90.3.
C'est roté l'ordre.
T'es
this year for the 9th annual Native Women's Shelter of Montreal's Spirit Walk fundraiser. Our theme is the idea that with strong foundations in place, space can be created for growth and new life. Join us for a walk on Mount Royal to raise funds so that women staying at the Native Women's Shelter will have access to a healing retreat and other workshops necessary to reground themselves, heal, and put solid foundations in place from which to move forward. Walk with us on June 10th on Mount Royal. For more information, search Spirit Walk MTL on